I'm Chris
Bristol
Giles.
Community FM 93.2.
Welcome back to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time, with Robin Clapp from the Bristol Anti-Cuts Alliance and me, Tony Gosling. Our wonderful coalition government has decided Remploy for disabled people must close, creating a much bigger tax bill. So what are they up to? Remploy have been employing thousands of disabled people since World War II. We find out live what fate is befalling the Bristol workers. And we go back to August 2010 to Stockholm with the help of an Australian TV documentary which examines the rape allegations against the man now famously stuck in Ecuador's Knightsbridge embassy. Plus, Bradley Stoke has an election coming up, so we've invited the three candidates to explain why you should vote for them. And that's where we start. First of all, then, let me introduce Caroline. Caroline, I'm just trying to find your surname, which is Sullivan, from the UK Independence Party. Now, I did invite Robin Horsfall from Labour and Paul Hardwick from the Conservatives too to come along, but they didn't return my calls. So thank you very much for coming in, Caroline. First of all, why did you decide you wanted to step into the breach and stand to be a councillor up in Bradley Stoke?
It wasn't a political reason, it was a personal reason. I'm very active in the community, have lived in the community for over 20 years, and my young family live there, so it was more of being involved in the community, and the political part came later.
Okay, so what do you actually do in the community? You say you're involved. In what way?
I don't work. I'm a stay-at-home mum. Unfortunately, I was medically retired from a job that I did 5 years ago, so I'm fortunate enough to stay at home with my children, who are primary school age. A couple of years ago, I was chair of the PTA of the primary school that they attend. I'm currently a scout leader and help out at the Beavers in our new scout club in Bradley Stoke. And I'm available to... I get involved in local concerns and local groups and seeing where I can help, because I have the time to do that.
Now, do you see yourself around Bradley Stoke, some of the councillors have got sort of business interests that get in the way? Because it sounds to me as if you've got a bit more free time than a lot of people.
I do have free time, and I do try and use it wisely. With regard to the other councillors, there's only a couple that I've actually met personally. So I'm not, obviously I hear things, and obviously the reason why I'm standing for councillor is because there is a vacancy, and I understand that the vacancy has come about someone not being able to commit the time that a councillor is required to commit to that duty, and I feel I can tick that boxes and be there for the people of that community and help them.
Now, Bradley Stoke's become something of a hotbed of Tory rebels over the past few months, with three Conservative councillors now defecting to the UK Independence Party, which is why it would be most interesting to see the outcome of this by-election in Meadowbank Ward. Now, just tell us whereabouts Meadowbank is in Bradley Stoke.
Well, Meadowbank is kind of central to Bradley Stoke, so there is a lot of housing there, and it's local businesses as well. So it's quite a condensed area, right in the hub of the town.
Now, you're standing as a United Kingdom Independence Party candidate there.
Yes.
What has Bradley Stoke, though, got to do with Britain's membership of the EU?
What indeed? The way I see it is, this is low-level politics. This is community level. This is about what the community wants. I think national politics and community politics should be kept separate. Some of my views may not be towing the party line as such, but what my views are for the community. It's elected councillors should be putting the community first, and not the party politics. And it's important that local issues should be put to the local people, so these people can make the decisions about the way and the area that they live in.
So why aren't you a Conservative, for example? Why the UK Independence Party?
To be honest, most of my past have been a Tory family, but I just can't trust them. The local coalition don't do anything for me. I can't trust them at all. I don't believe anything they say. They keep changing their mind. And UKIP spells common sense to me in almost every single one of their policies, from a local level to a national level. It's common sense. And to be honest, I think it's time we had a fresh change.
Yeah, so, I mean, hang on a minute. I mean, why can't you trust them? This is a little bit worrying to hear, that you actually feel that, you know, we need to be able to trust our politicians, don't
absolutely,
we?
Absolutely. I think they've kind of lost sight of the fact that we elected them. They work for us. We are the people that put them there because of what they said. And to not do what they said is a big letdown. It's a big betrayal. So I can't belong to a party. I've never belonged to a political party until UKIP came along. I never felt that need to be with one. But now, because I so wholeheartedly agree with the policies of UKIP, I feel that I'm going to put my money where my mouth is and be a member and do what I can to raise more awareness of that party and get them, you know, recognised for the party that they are.
Now, we've just heard from North Somerset, that's Liam Fox's constituency, that there's a bit of a row, not brewing, it's been, exploding for the last year or so, to use a military metaphor, because, of course, Liam Fox was the Defence Secretary up until recently, that there's a almost civil war going on within the North Somerset Conservative Party. Is this something that you think then is reflected in Bradley Stoke a bit? Because it does seem, maybe it's just because the Conservatives are the ruling party that this is going on.
I can't really comment on what goes on within the council. I've not been elected. I've never been to the council meeting. So I can't really comment on if there's any in-house fighting. I recognise through the press and obviously through what's being said that there is a lot of unrest and a lot of disgruntled Tories out there that are not so keen to belong to the party that they thought they belonged to. It's changed beyond recognition, I feel.
Okay, what way has it changed?
Again, with the coalition, there's a lot of Tories blaming Lib Dems, Lib Dems blaming Tories. No one's really taking responsibility for the actions that they're taking. There's a lot of mistrust. There's one of David Cameron's points for election was an in-out referendum for the EU. Well, that hasn't happened, and it's so unlikely to happen. People feel very betrayed about that because it is now affecting the person on the ground. And it was easy to say when the party politics are happening and you read about it in the paper, when it's not affecting you, it's easy to ignore it. But now it is affecting everybody. The cuts are affecting everybody. The taxes are affecting everybody. Small businesses, healthcare, frontline services, police, armed forces. Now it's starting to hurt. And people are realising that he's not doing what he said he would do.
Okay, now one of the policies that the UK Independence Party has come up with is this idea of outlawing veils. Now, is that something you go along with? Because, I mean, that sort of, it makes you tend to think that maybe UKIP is just a kind of another version of something like the BNP.
Absolutely not. We couldn't be further from BNP if we tried. In fact, the UKIP party is the only party that doesn't accept membership from ex-BNPs. It's an age-old rumour that started that UKIP are racist. It couldn't be further from the truth. We're not racist any shape or form, and this probably comes from our immigration policy. The immigration issues have to be addressed. We can't keep an open border policy going forever and a day. We just cannot, as a Great Britain, we cannot sustain that financially.
Now, Robin, I wonder if I can bring you in here. Robin Capp from Bristol and District Anti-Cuts Alliance. This is an awkward one, isn't it? Because sometimes people who say that we've got a too open immigration policy can be labelled as racist.
There is a debate to be had about open borders, and I think under capitalism, open borders will never be sustainable, either for those countries or for the individuals seeking to come into the country. Look, I have enormous sympathy with someone in Somalia or in Greece or anywhere else, in or out of the European Union, who wants to make a better life for themselves and is prepared to take the very brave step of emigrating. If I were in the position of a Somali family faced with 30 years of civil war, then I'm sure, like Caroline and many other people, I would be looking first and foremost to try and get a better life for my family, for my primary school children, whatever.
Yeah, but what about, say, for example, Eastern European migrants who aren't facing that kind of threat?
Well, we have within the European Union a situation where people can move from country to country. It's often forgotten that, you know, hundreds of thousands of young Britons are working in Europe. In the 1980s, in the last recession, in the 1980s, you know, tens of thousands of British workers went to Germany to work on the building sites, for instance. So, you know, there has always been a tendency for people to move and to use their skills in different countries. Coming out of the European Union, by the way, having a referendum on coming out of the European Union would be the quickest way to bring about a depression in Britain, because when you consider that 50% of Britain's trade goes with the European Union, if Cameron were to announce a referendum to come out of the European Union, the pound would sink through the floor. The cuts that we've seen so far would be inconsequential compared to the effect on ordinary people. But I do agree with Caroline about the fact that the mainstream parties don't offer anything to ordinary people. Personally, I believe we need a new party for working people, and I don't think that should be a party that puts immigration near the top of its agenda. It should be looking at the social questions of health, of education, of housing, of making sure that we build a Britain in the 21st century that is good for all the people.
But okay, what about immigration? Surely, Robin, we've got two things going on here. We've got the increase of people who've come from abroad has meant massive pressure on our housing system here, and also it's depressed wages and pay and conditions in Britain.
Yeah, but the question that no one ever asks is that, you know, immigration is used by many employers to drive down wages. We should be saying, instead of taking action against people who are coming here to work, that we should be uniting to get better wages, better conditions. Why is it houses aren't being built in this country? It's not because there are too many immigrants in the country. It's because a government has cut the housing budget to its core and has given up on the provision of social housing.
No, but actually, to be fair, that's not what I was saying. I'm saying that, you know, because of the influx of people into Britain, it's meant that there's a housing bubble being blown up, and also a lot of stress on our existing housing stock.
Then take action against private landlords, which inflate private rents. And, you know, if you look, go to London or any of the big cities of England, you will see people, not just immigrants, but people from Britain as well, living in substandard housing, paying through the nose private rented figures that would have been unacceptable 30 years ago. Let's take the agenda away from trying to find scapegoats who might happen to have a different colour or a different culture. And let's look at the rich people in this country, the bankers that we've talked about in the previous part of the programme, who have got their hands in all of our back pockets. Let's, instead of attacking each other, look at the common enemy, which is those people who've brought Britain to a position where you don't know if you've got a job next week, you don't know if your kids are going to get a university education, and you don't know if you're going to get a decent house.
OK, now, Caroline Sullivan, you're a UKIP candidate standing in the elections up in Bradley Stoke on Thursday, September the 6th. How do you answer that?
I agree with some points that Robin's made. I do think that there's a number of issues that he's raised all in one go. With the immigration issue, the point that I think UKIP stand for and what I stand for is that there are, with open borders, the influx of people, Great Britain cannot financially sustain those people. It's not about anything other than, if people want to come and live and work for a better life in Great Britain, then we are going to be there with open arms. No one is going to have a problem with that. But you must be able to provide for yourself. Come here with a skill. Come here with a job. Come here and provide for your family. Don't come here with your hand wide open and expect to be housed and money in your pocket within weeks of arriving at... when there are people here in Britain who can't access those housing, who can't get those benefits themselves, who are British. Now, that's not being racist. That's just saying, one of the old clichés, charity begins at home. Let's look after what we've got before we start saying to everybody, come here and enjoy it. Because they're not coming here and enjoying it. They're coming here because they can, some of them, and this is not all of them, are coming here because they can get something for nothing. And that is crippling us financially. So we're not...
So who would you actually point the finger of blame at there? Is this partly to do with the UK Independence Party anti-stance against the European Union?
I think it goes hand in hand with that. I don't think we need to belong to the European Union. We pay over £50 million a day when we're cutting our own frontline services. The money could be better used at home, and it's the money that we need here at home. Yet we're spending that money and getting very little gain. I don't believe that if we came out of the European Union that suddenly all all trade with Europe would stop. That's just absolute nonsense. Trade would continue. I don't think it would even affect us in the slightest.
How do you answer that one, Robin? Because, I mean, one of the things that's a real downer for me, for the EU, is the fact that it's totally undemocratic. None of the people who are the commissioners who are making these big decisions about, I mean, essentially they're called the government of Europe, and chaired by someone called, I think, Van Rompuy, who Nigel Farage is, if you go on YouTube and find that his Mickey take of Van Rompuy, who nobody really seems to know who he is. And also we've got Catherine Ashton, who's the foreign minister for the EU. She's actually never been elected by anybody, and she's there now doing putting sanctions on to Iran and doing negotiations with Burma. It's a total lack of democracy.
The European Union is a profoundly undemocratic organisation, and I'm not here to defend the European Union. The point I'm making is that the interrelationship of the European economy with the British economy is now at such an advanced stage that were Britain to extricate itself from the European Union, it's absolutely laughable to suggest there would be no difference, no effect felt. The days have long gone when we could import New Zealand butter and lamb and sustain ourselves by working with the former colonies. We live in a neo-global world. The city of London would straight away be diminished in the eyes of the other capitalist powers who would transfer all the wealth to Frankfurt or to Paris. And the reality is that I want to see a different kind of European Union. I want to see a European Union of ordinary people, a European Union that fights for the values of social democracy.
Yeah, but what we've got isn't that, Robin?
No, exactly. But if there were a referendum today, and you asked me would I vote for staying in the European Union or coming out of the European Union, then given the gangsters who control the EU, I wouldn't put my vote in favour of staying in a European Union run by the Troika and the European bureaucrats. That's not the point. I would ask the moot question of why Nigel Farage collects tens of thousands of pounds every day from sitting in the European Parliament. If it's an institution that he thinks is so corrupt, then why is he taking money from the European Parliament? But the point that UKIP really don't seem to grasp is that there is a bigger debate to be had. If we want to see a Britain which has all these improvements, and we all want that, then we have to address the question of who really owns Britain. And it's not the European Union itself, it's the same ruling class in this country that own Britain as have always owned Britain. When UKIP start marching against the bankers and start demanding that we have banks publicly owned so that they can lend money to small businesses and people in need of credit, then I'll listen to what UKIP have to say. But I would be interested in the question about the veil, which you asked, Tony, and you know, Caroline's view on that. I'd also ask the question, has there been a big influx of immigrants into Meadowbank Ward? Because I suspect there hasn't, and I suspect many of the social questions that you face in your ward about the cuts, which I agree with you about, are questions that you should be addressing to this coalition government and not seeking to scapegoat minority ethnic populations.
Okay, Caroline, will you answer that?
Well, again, this is local government, and trying to keep national politics away from local government is a big thing. I'm working for the community that I live in, for the majority of the community, so we've got a safer, stronger community, and I think there's a lot of national policies that don't need to touch the communities. This is, I'm a community activist wanting what's best for our community, for the young families that are growing up. Bradley Stoke is a relatively young town. It's a town in its own right. A lot of the people there who are working work in Bristol or Gloucester. It's you know, got brilliant access for other areas, but it's a town in its own right. We do have a diverse population there. We have a huge social housing community there, you know, and everybody needs a councillor that's going to work for them and can put party politics aside.
Okay, Caroline. Now, one thing I will really try and criticise you here for the UK Independence Party is it seems to be a party which is just based on a sort of negative idea, that is, we don't like the EU. Can you tell me what your vision is for Bradley Stoke and for Britain as a member of that party?
Well, this comes back to UKIP's, that, you know, a one party horse. It's not. That's how we may have started out. But we've got some very, very good policies that, you know, a huge manifesto that covers what it needs to cover, and it's given a fresh start and it's giving a change, because that's not what we're not getting. Labour, Lib Dem, Conservative, they're all the same. We need something different. We need some honesty, we need some integrity, we need something that, we need Britain ruled by the British. People can come here and live as the British do and they'd enjoy it, but not at the expense of the British. And like I said, with regards to the community politics, it's got to be kept separate from National Party politics. This is about the community, about what the people want. This is a democratic town. I hope I get elected. I'll be the first UKIP councillor to be elected on those democratic grounds.
Yeah, but you'll be joining another three who've defected from the Conservative Party.
Absolutely. Maybe we can give the Conservatives a run for the money then.
OK, and that by-election is due to take place on Meadowbank Ward in Bradley Stoke on Thursday, September the 6th. The ward includes Kemperley Way, Hawkins Crescent, Snowbury Close and Diana Gardens. And the other candidates who were asked if they wanted to come along today but didn't get back to me, Paul Hardwick of the Conservatives, he's from Hawkins Crescent, Bradley Stoke, and Robin Horsfall from Brins Close, Stoke, Gifford. And thank you very much, Caroline Sullivan, for joining me this evening.
Thank you.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Now on to look around some of the stories around the world, with Robin Clapp from Bristol District Anti-Cuts Alliance. Robin, we've heard quite a lot about Syria again this week, and also it looks like a bit of a problem in Lebanon too. Now, these two countries historically were actually one, weren't they?
That's correct. And what happens in Syria does have repercussions for Lebanon. As you say, we are seeing the fracturing of Syria at the moment, and that is beginning to have an effect on Lebanon. And what the fear must be that we could see a return to the terrible civil war that we saw in the 1970s and 1980s, where you had Shiites fighting Sunnis, you had different tribes, the Druze, for instance, who are a particular ethnic group, also involved in a three-pronged civil war. And the fourth part of that were the Christian Maronites, who traditionally have been the main commercial class in Lebanon. So it's a nightmare for the West.
Okay, but to what extent is this a genuine civil war which is brewing up from within, or to what extent is there outside intervention here? Because certainly a lot of the Free Syrian Army seem to be being now equipped with weapons via Turkey and other countries. I mean, having things like anti-tank weapons. Now, you don't see demonstrators, peaceful demonstrators, walking down the streets in Bristol with an anti-tank gun, do you?
No, clearly. And it's been revealed in the last couple of days that the Germans as well have been involved in supplying intelligence and possibly weapons to the Free Syrian Army. There is a civil war taking place. The problem for the West is there is no real way they can go into Syria in the way they did in Iraq. It's not a straightforward case. They thought when they went into Iraq they could surgically remove Saddam Hussein, they would be seen as the liberators of Iraq and everything would be great and they could get their hands on the oil. Well, they got their hands on the oil. The trouble is they haven't in any way, shape or form improved the lives for ordinary Iraqis, and you have a low-level civil war even taking place in parts of Iraq. But Syria is a completely different ball game. Syria is a patchwork of different tribes, different traditions, different ethnic minorities. And what you have now is atrocities on both sides. You have people intervening not because of political ideals, but because they are seeking to gain territorial advantage, carrying out reprisals against people from other tribes. The West can only stand back. What I would say, Tony, is that what you reap, you sow. Syria was an artificial state. It was constructed by the Western powers in the early years of the 20th century. It was a time bomb waiting to go off. And it won't be the last time. If this situation in Syria deteriorates, it will have repercussions among the Gulf states, among Saudi Arabia as well, and Turkey.
But we've heard this week from David Cameron, our Prime Minister, and Barack Obama. They're warning Syria over chemical weapons. Cameron and the US President agreed the use of chemical weapons in Syria, or even a threat to deploy them, would be completely unacceptable. In a phone call, the two leaders said if President Assad made such a move, it would force them to revisit their approach. yeah. so far. Now, this is an implied threat, isn't it? It's an implied threat to say that that really they are now considering ignoring the views of the Chinese and the Russians at the Security Council and saying, well, we may just decide to do something unilaterally if there's a threat to use chemical weapons. Now, a threat, that could come from anywhere. It could be a false threat. It could be anything. And so we're going down a rather a dangerous road here, aren't we?
It's talking big. And, you know, we have heard William Hague beating his breast and saying he's going to send British police into the embassy in London to remove Julian Assange. And often these Tories make statements that they don't actually think about before opening their mouths. What is their response likely to be to chemical weapons? Well, there's only two responses. One would be surgical airstrikes, except that the Syrian weaponry is hid much more cleverly than the Iraqi weaponry, and no doubt any airstrikes from the West would cause civilian casualties. The other thing, which I think is extremely unlikely, is, you know, the consideration of sending land troops into Syria. That would not be politically acceptable in Britain or the US, and it would have incalculable consequences for the stability of the entire Middle East. So they talk big. But
the other problem, of course, here is that if there was to be some sort of chemical weapon attack, it would be very difficult to prove who'd even done it. I mean, it could even be done as a provocation.
Well, absolutely. And so the West is, you know, now saying that Saddam Hussein must be got rid of. It's not Saddam Hussein, that Assad must be got rid of. Let's not forget, it was only a few years ago that Saddam was given the red carpet treatment in London, as before him, Saddam Hussein. So, you know, these people in the West, they were quite prepared to tolerate the atrocities of the Assad regime so long as it didn't affect them. Now they're very worried.
Now, you mentioned the Germans. This is actually pretty devastating, because this is the first time since World War II the German Parliament have just voted now, and German courts have just ruled that the Germans, for the first time since the Second World War, can go on manoeuvres and have military activities outside Germany. This is the first time for 60 years.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's predictable in my view. I'll not make a big thing about the fact the German army is going on manoeuvres. The German army is a professional army. It's no more dangerous than the British army, the American army. The reality is it's upping the ante. And what you have now is a situation where the Western powers are putting themselves in a very clear confrontation with Russia and China. This would have huge implications if there were any suggestion that they were going to use reprisals. It would destabilise the situation in Turkey. The Russians would retaliate in terms of taking money out of Cyprus, for instance, destabilising Cyprus, because the Russians have bailed out the Cypriot economy. There are all sorts of consequences. So Cameron and Hague and Obama as well, for that matter, are really out of their depth. I guess what they would like to see in their dreams is the Israelis get them out of the mess by going into airstrikes in Syria. But even the Israeli military are wary of actually trying to do this.
Well, I wonder whether what's been going on here is that everyone's been, I mean, Germany's a NATO country, they've been tugging at the Germans saying, I mean, come on, you should help us with what we're doing in Syria. And they've finally relented and they've said yes. But I mean, this is does set a precedent, doesn't it? I mean, after the Second World War, this is the very first time ever. You think that this is there's nothing particularly alarming?
No, it's a precedent, but I don't think it ought to. The situation in terms of the options that the West has. The reality is that they cannot easily displace Assad and tame Syria as they would like to do. And what they would find in Syria is what we have seen in Tunisia, what we have seen in Egypt, which is that, and in particular in Libya, which is that the country will destabilize. There are fault lines, geographical fault lines throughout Syria. They would open up again, and as you said at the outset, they would spill over into Lebanon. So, you know, it may be that a section of the Israeli ruling class decide to try and engage in surgical strikes against Syria's chemical weapons bases, against the nuclear weapon facilities or the sub-nuclear weapon facilities they have. But nevertheless, these are very big stakes they're playing for. And it's interesting that even the Israeli military have actually cautioned Netanyahu to the extent that they've said, look, this is not a game of soldiers. This is a hard one for us.
OK, how do we stop this?
I think that the people of Syria have to form, you know, neighbourhood defence committees. They have to ensure in each area they try to elect people who come together in the communities to defend and protect their communities against aggression from whatever quarter.
Okay, and we're also joined now by Judith Brown. Hi, Judith. Welcome to Drive Time. Now, when was the last time you were in Yemen? Because you've been following all this.
I was in Yemen last year. I was there at the time of the uprising, and in Aden at the time that people were being killed.
Can you just give us your views on what's been going on in Iran, Syria, and that part of the world then since you were last here?
Well, I think the situation is in the Middle East is almost unreadable. There's so many changes going on and things happen and so many contradictions. I mean, you're talking about Syria, for example, at the moment, a lot of the jihadists there are what could be termed al-Qaeda under other circumstances, but they're being given intelligence by the West and given sort of like money and aid in various forms. And then allies of America like Qatar are giving them weapons, whilst at the same time the people are operating exactly the same way in Yemen, being subject to drone attacks and being sort of more drone attacks are happening in Yemen and have been this year than there have been in Pakistan. So there's all of these sort of like contradictions, and it's very difficult to read how it's going to go. I mean, I don't see any way out of the situation in Syria, and when I talk to friends there, they don't see any way out either, and the majority of people that I know say, well, we don't support them, and we don't support them either. In other words, you've got these sort of like two groups fighting in Syria, and the ordinary population don't really have very much of a view on, you know, which side is they support. You know, they just want to be free of the war.
Okay, so yeah. How does NATO headquarters in Brussels, how do they actually decide which al-Qaeda they're going to support and which one is going to be the enemy?
Exactly.
Robin, do you want any idea?
Well, we've been here before, haven't we, Tony? In the Iran-Iraq war, Saddam Hussein was deemed by the West to be a responsible ally and was given lots of weapons by the West, by the United States. He was wooed as a safe pair of hands against the godless Iranian regime, as the US saw it. And of course, that came back to bite the US later. And I think it is very, very damning indictment of the power politics that go on in the Middle East, that as my colleague has said, you have jihadists at the moment being funded, being given overt intelligence and so on in order to unseat Assad. Yet these jihadists want to construct in Syria a society that for the ordinary people will be very different and in some ways perhaps even more ferocious than the society that exists in Syria. Both of these groups, the jihadists, the Free Syrian Army, not all of them necessarily, but large parts of them, it would seem, have really an agenda that leaves out of account the interests of the ordinary suffering people of Syria. And what we don't have at the moment in Syria is that the social forces come into the fore that we saw in Egypt with the Cairo Spring. And, you know, that means that in the short term, I think it can only get worse in Syria.
Now, yeah. Judith, you are part of this Arab Media Watch. What do you think about the way that it's been reported, these various conflicts in Yemen and Syria particularly?
Well, I think that it's been reported very selectively. It is quite interesting. I mean, there are certain papers that do give a different slant. I don't know whether you've read any of Robert Fisk's articles this week in The Independent, where he's actually talking about the army in Aleppo and in very sympathetic terms, you know, the way that they're being attacked and the way that the ordinary people in Aleppo are supporting the army but their lives are just sort of like being sort of like devastated. And for the army, it's very difficult because there's so many snipers in the rebels. And he's looking very sympathetically at the way that the army is fighting and presenting them as a professional force. So sometimes you do get sort of, you know, the occasional sort of article that says something different to sort of like the normal run of things. Whereas if you read the normal media, you would be imagining that the Assad regime doesn't have any support of the people at all. Of course, I mean, I think Assad has made a lot of mistakes in the way that he's handled it, and in a sense, he's fed into the hands of the people who want the downfall of the Syrian regime. And I think that the downfall of the Syrian regime, as far as maybe lots of people in the West feel and the Israeli government feels, is if the Syrian regime downfalls, then it's going to make the position of Iran much weaker. And obviously that comes into the calculation. But, I mean, just awful things have been happening in Yemen, for example, which has been very underreported. I mean, it really is a state that's in a state of huge collapse at the moment. There's incredible food insecurity. I think that's also a bit invisible because what's reported by organisations like Oxfam is that when people in Yemen, when their children and elderly people are dying, the most vulnerable people who tend to die first, they tend not to sort of like walk and move, you know, out of the country as sort of or into different parts of the country as refugees. They tend to go into their houses and die in their houses. In other words, accept that as a sort of like a natural way of life. So the humanitarian crisis isn't so visible, but it's there.
Now, I've noticed the BBC and ITN particularly showing a lot of YouTube films of action, supposedly to do with the Free Syrian Army film shot by the Free Syrian Army, and they always say at the end of it, oh, we can't verify this. Now, this starts to bother me because if you can't verify something, surely you can't really sort of put it out to the general public in their living rooms as news.
Yeah.
So what are your thoughts about that side of things?
Well, I mean, to me, I'm not sure what the purpose is in showing it except as propaganda. I mean, I can't see any other purpose. But to me, if the West really wanted Syria to be in peace, well, surely they would arrange for people to sit down round a table with people that they hate and put pressure on people to sit round a table with people that they hate and talk peace. So you're never going to get peace if you have a peace conference in which you don't invite Assad or any of the countries that support
him. What they're saying is that what the NATO side really and the Free Syrian Army, which is very, very closely aligned to it, are saying is that we won't start negotiations until Assad leaves.
Exactly. So therefore you're saying that peace can't ensue because you're not going to have peace until Assad leaves, until Assad joins in the negotiation. You've got to sit around a table and talk to the people on all sides. You can't have peace negotiations that excludes one important partner to the peace negotiations.
Okay, what about the Arab channels? I'm talking about Al Jazeera, Al Arabiya. Can you tell us whereabouts they come from and whether they've given a different coverage?
Well, I haven't been looking at them for a long time because I haven't really seen them since I've been in Yemen.
Well, we can get Al Jazeera here in Bristol on Freeview and various other places, satellites and things like that. But okay, so talk about the politics of those channels then.
Of the Middle East channels?
Yeah, because they seem to be largely from the pro-Western states like Qatar.
Qatar has enormous influence for its size, and now of course it's also extremely wealthy. But I think a lot of people think that Al Jazeera is like a completely off the card voice of Arabs, quite militant. But in fact, it's the analysis that Arab Media Watch have done in the past have shown that the coverage that they have of events like, for example, the Palestine-Israeli conflict are not that dissimilar to the coverage that are on sort of like mainstream channels in UK like BBC and ITV. So I don't think that they're that much different. But where they are different, if they differ at all, then obviously they're made out to be a really extreme broadcaster, but that's not the case.
Al Jazeera being based in Qatar and Al Arabiya based in Saudi Arabia. So they're both
based in the Emirates, I think.
Oh, is it? Okay.
Yeah,
so we're getting a slightly different view from there, but it's also largely pro-Western, Robin.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, one of the things that really concerns me now is, you know, where do they go in relation to Iran? Because we've heard over the last few days again, you know, voices saying that the real problem is Iran. Iran is manipulating Syria. And, you know, one of the things that I think is quite evident is that the West would love to be able to deal with the Iranian regime, but they're impotent in many ways from doing so because Iran is such a huge player in the Middle East, and again, the idea of a land invasion or even surgical strikes against Iranian military installations ratchets up the odds enormously. My feeling is that the losers in this, as is always the case, are the ordinary Syrian people. I've no doubt whatsoever that many Syrian people are suspicious of the Free Syria Army and the methods that we've seen on show in the last few weeks. I'm also utterly convinced that many people are repelled by the dictatorial regime that has been the Assad regime and remember back to the previous atrocities of Assad's father and so on. And so the question of questions is, can a third force emerge which can actually bring about some salvation for the ordinary people?
Well, that's a big question.
But is it emerging anyway? I mean, if you look at Egypt, it's still a military dictatorship. It's not actually any different. It wasn't a very, very big revolution.
All
the same people
agree.
Are still in power.
Robin,
and if you look at Libya, I mean, it's really in a state of civil war going on now. But it's never reported as such.
Okay.
You know, they're reported as something that the West helped and that are now, you know, now these people are getting on with a sort of like a free democratic process, which is really
well, we've
not
heard
true.
About bomb attacks in Libya over the last few weeks as well.
Yes, we have
we?
Indeed.
So where, just to wind up, Judith, can you tell us whereabouts we go online? Because it's quite difficult to find, certainly if you don't have Freeview or if you don't have one of these Arabic channels to get a different point of view, where can you go online to find out what's going on?
Well, I'm not quite sure. I mean, I personally belong to lots of sort of like lists and also have lots of friends in the country, so I can sort of like ring up and sort of like find out information. So so I personally get information direct. I'm
well,
not
one of the
sure.
places I've been going to, which seems to have been down many times, like WikiLeaks was down, Russia Today was taken down as well by these cyber attacks, which is called Sana, which is a Syrian Arab news agency, which has an English language service. And the Lebanese government also have an English language one, so at least you're getting two points of view if you can get those, but obviously you can't when the websites are down. Anyway, Judith Brown from Arab Media Watch, thanks very much for joining us this evening.
Thank you.
Drive Time on BCFM 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Now, last Thursday, the Ecuadorian government granted asylum to WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, who's incarcerated in the Ecuadorian embassy in Knightsbridge still. But the reason he's there is hotly disputed. A Swedish woman has accused him of rape, but the next day they were best of friends, and she was tweeting about how cool he is. So there is the Australian ABC television put together a documentary, and we're going to have a listen to that now. They did an investigation over in Stockholm into what exactly happened 2 years ago, and this is through facts which have been verified by both the parties in the court case.
Using facts agreed between the defence and prosecution and other verified information, we've pieced together what happened during those crucial 3 weeks in August. On August the 11th, 2010, Assange arrived to attend a conference organised by the Swedish Brotherhood, a branch of the Social Democratic Party. He was offered Anna Ardin's apartment while she was away, but Ardin returned home a day early on Friday the 13th. She invited Assange to stay the night, and they had sex. She would later tell police Assange had violently pinned her down and ignored her requests to use a condom. Assange denies this. The following day, Assange addressed the conference with Ardin at his side. Later that afternoon, Ardern organised the Swedish equivalent of a top-notch barbecue, a crayfish party. She posted a Twitter message. Julian wants to go to a crayfish party. Anyone have a couple of available seats tonight or tomorrow? The crayfish party was held that night in a courtyard off her apartment. It went on until the early hours of the morning. Ardern tweeted at 2 a.m. Sitting outdoors at 2 o'clock and hardly freezing with the world's coolest, smartest people. It's amazing. A guest at the party would later tell Swedish police the event was a very hearty evening. When he offered to put Assange up at his apartment, Ardern replied, "He can stay with me." In the past 24 hours, Ardern had worked closely with Assange, had sex with him, organised a crayfish party on his behalf, and according to one witness, turned down alternative accommodation for him. Afterwards, Assange would again spend the night at her apartment. The following day, August the 16th, Assange had sex with Sophia Willen at her apartment. According to police records, Arden was aware that he had slept with Sophia. A witness told police he contacted Anna Arden looking for Assange. She texted back, "He's not here. He's planned to have sex with the Kashmir girl every evening, but not made it. Maybe he finally found time yesterday." That same day, the witness asked Arden, "Is it cool he's living there? Do you want, like, for me to fix something else?" According to the witness, she replied, "He doesn't like sleep at nights, so that's a bit difficult. So he has a bit of a difficulty taking care of his hygiene, but it's okay, he lives with me. It's no problem." 3 days later, on August the 20th, Willen, accompanied by Arden, went to the Klara police station in central Stockholm to seek advice about whether Assange could be forced to take an STD test. Arden had gone along primarily to support Willen. Sometime during Willen's questioning, the police announced to Arden and Willen that Assange was to be arrested and questioned about possible rape and molestation. Willen became so distraught, she refused to give any more testimony and refused to sign what had already been taken down.
Okay, that was the ABC documentary we just heard there, all about Julian Assange's trip in, 2 years ago in 2010. Robin Clapp from the Anti-Cuts Alliance. Well, you did say a few things about this in the first hour, but how do you think we've ended up in this situation with the BBC actually saying that they will not name any of the people involved in the rape allegations, even though legally they have absolutely no problem in doing so, and certainly it looks as if these people are quite willing to be named because they've gone to the authorities and their names have been circulated all around the world's press, it seems, except on the BBC.
Well, that documentary quote we've just heard is a revelation. It raises many more questions than it answers in terms of what are the real reasons that Assange is being suspected of rape. But the thing is, as I said before, Tony, that the Swedish police should come over to Britain and should offer to meet Julian Assange, if necessary, in the Ecuadorian embassy. I just feel that, you know, there are many, many questions here, but the real agenda behind the scene is that the Swedish government will be trying to comply with the American government's requirement to have him extradited to the US, because when the American government takes aim at you and decides you're someone they don't like, they will try and get you by any means possible. And, you know, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but I do wonder when I hear those quotes from that woman whether or not this is about alleged rape or whether this is really part of a sting to get Julian Assange's head on a plate delivered to Washington.
Now, Sweden has consistently submitted to pressure from the US in matters of civil rights. This is in John Pilger's article, Pursuit of Julian Assange is an Assault on Freedom and a Mockery of Journalism. He says, in December 2001, the Swedish government abruptly revoked the political refugee status of two Egyptians, Ahmed Agiza and Mohamed Zari, who were handed to a CIA kidnap squad at Stockholm Airport and rendered to Egypt, where they were tortured. And also the Swedish Foreign Minister, Carl Bildt, not only is he a member of the notorious Bilderberg Club, which I've got a website about if you want to have a look at that, he played a notorious leading role in George W. Bush's Committee for the Liberation of Iraq, and he also retains close ties to the Republican Party's extreme right. So Assange is dealing with some pretty dicey characters at the top of Swedish society.
Absolutely, and that's only the tip of the iceberg. I think the truth is that there have been high-level discussions behind the scenes about delivering up Julian Assange, and, you know, as I said before, we don't want to minimise any accusations of rape. They need to be judicially investigated. But the idea that he goes back to Sweden when he's not even been charged and that he will then be given safe passage to stay in Sweden. You'd have to be very naive to believe that the Swedish government is going to break the habit of a lifetime and put two fingers up to the US government. On the contrary, they were given to the US.
Well, it seems very strange to be in a situation where someone in London, in order to get justice, has to go to the Ecuadorian embassy of all places in order to find it.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Well, I'm joined now by Mark Cambridge from Bristol Remploy. Now, Mark, can you just bring us up to date what's been going on Remploy? Because I heard last week, I think it was beginning of last week, that some of the sites in other parts of the country have been closed down.
Yes, that is correct. 27 sites are closing this month. As far as our site, Remploy Bristol, is concerned, there has been an expression of interest in our site, but we still have no idea who that person or persons may or may not be, or what their intentions may or may not be.
Well, that's a bit awkward, isn't it, leaving you in the lurch like that? And I wonder if this is on a bit of a knife edge, which it sounds like it might be, if whoever it is, very strange to leave you in the lurch like that, but maybe, you know, they would be encouraging more investors. If someone listening knows somebody who might want to invest in Bristol Remploy, I would have thought there would be more of a campaign to actually get it known that there was a group that the people could go to actually help rescue Remploy.
Yeah, you would think that. I mean, personally myself, I would think in an ideal world, the more competition there is for the site, the better. But at the moment, there's been an air of secrecy for quite some time now over the whole situation, which certainly is affecting morale at the site. And we're all very, very angry and very, very frustrated about the situation, because it's making it very, very difficult for us to plan our futures and look beyond the next few days.
It sounds like almost as if someone somewhere is trying to wear down your morale.
Yes, it does feel like that, and I'm sure through speaking and listening to my colleagues over the last few weeks and months, I do detect that from spending a lot of time with them over the last.
So how many people are actually employed here in Bristol?
There's 28 at the Remploy Bristol site.
And what about wider across the whole country? Because many of these people, I mean, you were just saying nearly 30 sites being closed down. I mean, how many people are going to be affected by this closure?
I'm not too sure of the specific numbers, but you are talking rather a large number of people that have been forced out of work and have got very uncertain futures ahead.
Now, Robin Clapp from the Anti-Cuts Alliance, this seems to be a no-brainer, doesn't it? Really does, because the Bristol factory, we've heard, is actually a money-making concern. They've got a full order book. I mean, they may not be making a fortune, enough for some people, but if Mark and his colleagues are sacked, they will be a massive drain on the economy. So it makes sense, surely, to subsidise even though they're making money. It doesn't make sense to me, this whole story.
These employees don't want a subsidy. They want the opportunity to do the job they've been doing very, very efficiently and to carry on with meaningful employment. I'm very proud to have gone to the picket lines to offer my support to the Remploy workers when they recently were forced into taking industrial action. And it is a disgrace that this government, which says it supports the rights of people with disabilities, is in effect washing its hands of Remploy and throwing it to the private sector, or setting those workers in a position where they won't probably work again in some cases. These factories were set up after 1945 to provide employment for workers who have been injured in the war. I know from talking to Mark and his colleagues that in Bristol they do a really brilliant job, and it is really a summary of everything that is wrong with this government.
Yeah, we
that
know,
it rewards
we know
bankers and throws Remploy workers out of work.
We know it's unjust, Robin, but what can we do?
Well, I think at this stage we can hope that a buyer comes along and keeps the Bristol factory open. But I have to say that my experience of these kind of takeovers is that they come at a cost, and that cost may be jobs, it may be the erosion of conditions and rates of pay. Let's hope not. But what we can do in terms of this particular case is using it as one more example of why we have to get this government out as quickly as possible. It's wrecking the public sector. It's a government bent on ideology, and this is all about saving money, giving fat cat employers the chance to make more money by taking over Remploy factories, which are working perfectly well at the moment. Leave them alone. The people who should be made redundant are Cameron and Clegg.
Okay, now Mark, how can people help, finally?
Well, people up and down the country can help by logging on to Facebook, logging on to Twitter, logging on to the GMB website, the Unite website. Leave messages of support for us there. It will raise awareness. It will spread the message throughout the country, throughout large numbers of people throughout the whole country. That would be one of the most effective ways of raising awareness, which we critically need.
Maybe some money might help as well. I mean, if this investor, whoever they are, if they really exist, and I'm afraid, you know, I have my doubts about that, because of the way that if you were an honest investor, you would think that actually you want to get everybody on board rather than demoralise everybody. I imagine that you're after that too.
Yes, I mean, there has been a very, very big strain on everybody at Remploy Bristol over the last few weeks and months. The sooner this veil of secrecy is lifted and we're made aware of who the expression of interest is and what their intentions are, the better. We need to know what direction we're going in for the future. We're very, very concerned, whatever way it goes, whether the site closes or whether we're 2P'd over, because whatever way it goes, it could lead to us being unemployed at some stage, and the consequences of that would be disastrous for my colleagues and I.
Okay, well, thank you very much for joining us again this evening. Well, that's all the serious talk out of the way, because Friday night is music night, kicking off with 2 hours live with Spike, Rodsey and Pat Hart, maybe a selection of those, inviting you to join them at the Fresh Blood Party. Thanks to our guests in the first hour, Conservative Councillor for Avonmouth, Siobhan Kennedy Hall, also Caroline Sullivan from UKIP, Judith Brown from Arab Media Watch, Mark Cambridge from Bristol Remploy. Also thanks, of course, to Robin Clapp from the Bristol and District Anti-Cuts Alliance for filling in over the last month for Old Labour Oxford Economy Martin Summers, who'll be back with a bang, no doubt, next week. And next week we have £21 trillion in the tax havens. The Tax Justice Network come to town. Every BCFM show is available online. Just go to bcfm.org.uk, or even easier, thisweek.org.uk takes you straight to this show and our archives. The podcast of this show is online 10 minutes or so after broadcast. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend, and I leave you in the capable hands of Pat Hart and the Fresh Blood Party crew.
Ratchet man, I pass through. We let everybody know, sir. What?